Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, February 6th, 2011, and this is show number 298. We got a whole bunch to talk about this week, so settle in for your long commute, Dean. You're going to have plenty of entertainment. By the way, it will be a miracle if the show actually comes off. At 11 this morning, I had some real weirdness. I'm typing away, doing an email, type. Suddenly, my screen turns blue, and then when it came back in like 3 seconds, my Mac acted like it had rebooted. I was like, what the heck? And so I start tweeting, and at this point, all I'm running is my Twitter client, because it just, quote-unquote, rebooted, and it happened a second time. I was freaking out. So again, I was able to tweet. At that point, I unplugged my external drive. I wasn't sure if it had anything to do with it. I got some good advice from Victor Cahiao and some others. And in the end, I got on FaceTime with Bart, and he walked me through downloading and running TechTool Deluxe. After working it for a while, we managed to get it to the point where the disk was unmountable. We ran TechTool Deluxe another time and got it mostly fixed. We think it's working. Like right now, that's the drive I'm doing some of the data on here. But there's this weird folder with a bunch of weird looking files in it. Kind of looks like TechTool Deluxe couldn't fix what was ailing those 300 files. The good news is that I am religious about doing my backup, so I have a bootable backup clone from just yesterday. So I was able to boot from it while we were running TechTool Deluxe. And it was annoying. I mean, it was work. We had to do it. We had to figure it out. But I didn't have that fear and that cold feeling in your gut when you realize that you're caught with your pants down without a backup drive. So I knew I could just drop back to that bootable backup clone if I needed to. It was really a great feeling. So I also use Ron's Automator script to back up the show notes every few minutes to Dropbox, so I knew I could get back in business really quickly if things did go belly up. Now, Bart suggests that I do a nuke and pave to my bootable super-duper backup right after the show because those dodgy files make him nervous that something won't work right sometime soon. I hope I have time to do that tonight. Anyway, we better kick into the show before my hard drive fails. So picture this. We're on our way to Macworld. Steve and I and Katie have successfully flown to San Francisco, and we've excitedly jumped on the Bay Area Transit District, also known as BART. No relation to the real BART, of course. We've been playing for 3 solid days, so we're just kind of kicking back on the train. Now, Steve and I are not experienced train riders, but we love how efficient it is to move around San Francisco compared to the way LA is, where you just have to drive everywhere. That inexperience was most evident on this particular trip. So I'm relaxing away. I took a few pictures with my Nikon D40 SLR camera, and then I set it on top of my luggage with a strap casually strung over the top of the handle. And then the train stopped. But my camera didn't. With 6 years of engineering school under my belt, you would think that I had mastered Newton's first law, which is commonly described as a body in motion tends to stay in motion. But evidence proves that this concept is still just outside of my grasp. Speaking of outside of my grasp, I leapt forward and tried to catch the camera before it flew forward onto the floor. I don't care if Katie tells you that I actually pushed it. I really was just trying to catch it. The good news is that my camera was undamaged. The bad news was that my 55 to 200 millimeter lens no longer has autofocus capability. Well, you know what that means, right? An opportunity to spend money on gadgets. The first thing I did was text Victor Cahiao of the Typical Shutterbug podcast and ask him advice on a replacement. He suggested the Sigma 18 to 200 millimeter f 3.5 to 6.3 lens. He told me that this lists at a good price for around $370. I was pretty pleased with that. I thought a lens with that much range from a very, very wide angle to a huge zoom would just cost me a fortune. Now, of course, I knew I'd be at the mercy of whoever I went to in San Francisco, so I figured I'd never get that kind of price, and it was probably a goat rope to try to buy it there. I was probably going to have to wait till I get back. But as I was complaining about this, I said, I was thinking, how do I find a place that that sells camera stuff? And Katie Floyd said, gosh, Allison, if you just had some sort of gadget that you could hold in your hand that you could, I don't know, bring up a map or something and type in the word camera. Shut up, Katie. So anyway, I used Google Maps. I searched for camera and I found Discount Camera right around the corner. I called them up and they said they had the lens in stock, but told me I'd have to go there in person to get the price. That had me worried. So I begged Victor to go with me. Well, your next question should be, how many podcasters does it take to buy a lens? In the end, it was me, Steve, Victor, Katie, George Starcher, Tim Chat, and Jeff Gamet, and I think Joseph Nilo might have been there too, I'm not sure. We basically mobbed this place. The great news is that they had the lens for $399, and the guy quickly verified that my camera was fine, but my old lens was definitely borked up. Throw on a UV filter and the exorbitant tax for California, and we were in business. So, how did the lens perform? Well, I simply love this lens. Steve was worried it would be too heavy for me, and it is heavy, but the thing is, it's only one lens. There's no more fooling around between my small zoom and my big zoom, asking someone to hold stuff for me while I switch the two lenses. No more removing the lens and getting dust on my sensor, making me have to go to Nikon and beg them yet again to blow my sensor off for me, like I had to do for the third time right before leaving for Macworld. I think that I went a total of 4 months between times I had to go get it blown off. Now, this lens is actually slower than my old lens when you get out to 200 millimeters, but it's about the same as at 18 millimeters as my wide-angle zoom that does still work. But I gotta tell you, the flexibility to be able to carry one lens and instantly adapt to a wide-angle group shot or take a picture of a bird in a tree, it's fantastic. I used Donald's conference photography tips when we went to see Sinbad's presentation at Macworld. Luckily, I was in the front row, but I set my ISO to 1600, I set my white balance, and then I set to shutter priority, and I played around with 1/60th and 1/20th, 1/120th, because that guy just would not stay still. I took about 30 pictures, and I got a half a dozen that I really, really liked. I had super sharp focus, not too much noise. Note to self, look at that noise filter program Donald talked about. And I was able to show how much fun Sinbad had during the presentation because you can really see his beautiful teeth, his smile, and his laughter. I took a ton of other pictures at other events at Macworld, and my close-ups of products came out really, really cool with that new lens. I put a pile of links in the show notes of each of the Flickr sets I created for the Mac Roundtable Live, the Smile Party, the Sinbad Keynote, one I call Friends and Fun at Macworld, the Nosilla Castaways Party over at Jillian's, and the My Mac Podcast Live on Stage with Tim Robertson and Guy Searle. Well, speaking of the Nosilla Castaways Party, I think it was a raging success. My one regret is that there were so many people, I didn't really get to spend any quality time with any one person. I was just kind of flitting around, you know, having fun with each person for about 20 seconds apiece. I do have a plan for an improvement next year, though. I think I'm going to ask Zach to be our bouncer. I want him to check off names as people come in. I found out halfway through the party that a marketing woman had put the Nosilla Castaways party on the party list, which explained why hovering near the door and eating a lot of hors d'oeuvres a bunch of people who never came in and said hi. Both Victor and Katie bounced a few of them, but I think it would have been even more fun and easier to breathe if we hadn't had these party crashers in there in the first place. Needless to say, I bounced her out, that's for sure. But in the middle of the show, we even brought Bart, Kevin, and Donald in on Skype video so they could be passed around and enjoy the party a bit too. It's kind of weird because we can't hear what they say, but they could wave at everybody and we could say hi to them. So special thanks to everyone who donated to the party. You made it a raging success. Special thanks to George from Tulsa for donating to the party and sending another banner for it, even though he doesn't get to come. It makes it so festive to have his banners up at the party. Now, I'm really tempted to try to talk about each person I got to meet and talk to, but I would be sure to miss someone and then they'd be sad. So I'll just say that I loved meeting, hanging out with all of you again, and until next year. Well, I think it's time to play some more interviews. Remember, these interviews are also available over on podfeet.com in video form if you'd like to go and watch the demos. All right, I'm in the dry case booth with Corey Heim, and I wanted to talk to you because I spill on everything. I don't need something to go diving with. I just need it for my daily life, but why don't you tell us what this is about?
Sure. So the dry case is a patented vacuum seal case for any size phone or camera or MP3 player. It works great with all the different versions of the iPhone. Basically, you just vacuum seal out the air, and it makes it completely 100% waterproof. So you can see before you use it.
If you're just listening to this, he's just used a little air pump and sucked the air right out of this Ziploc looking kind of thing.
Yep, and as you can see here, you have full functionality of the touchscreen. You can use the touchscreen through it. The headphone jack is built in so you can listen to music, and it's crystal clear so you can take photos and videos through it.
Oh, that's crazy. turn it around? So you're saying the camera works on the other side?
So it vacuum seals to the camera lens as well.
Okay, so it's actually dipped into the little socket where the camera is, so it doesn't distort the pictures?
Nope. Yep, okay. Crystal clear.
Take a picture with it. Let me see.
Sure.
All right, he just took a picture, and it looks crystal clear. That's crazy. So it's got a wrist sleeve on it?
Yeah, it has an armband. You can use that to attach it to your arm while you're running or swimming, or you can attach that to your kayak or your boat or, you know, whatever you want.
Or are you going to Disneyland or something like that, one of those water rides? That's where everybody breaks their phones, right?
Yeah, we have a few of those customers as well.
That's pretty cool. And how much does this cost?
It retails for $39.99, and it comes with the armband and the pump and a neck lanyard, so you can kind of use those features or not.
So how do you get the air back into it?
You just open the lock enclosure up top like that.
Okay.
And just lets the air back in. You can slip the phone right out.
Wow, that's crazy. And the headphone jack is already pre-sealed in there. So you plug it in and then suck the air out of it.
Yep, absolutely.
That's
and we
really
have
cool.
Dry Buds waterproof earphones that we sell as well. They're an accessory to the product. So if you really want to take the product to full extreme and listen to music, you can do that.
Swimming laps in a pool, you got to have something. All I ever did was memorize the states in alphabetical order to entertain myself.
There you go.
So where can they buy this?
We have a number of retail locations in the U.S. If you go to our website, drycase.com, there's a dealer locator, so you can see if there's a dealer near you. If not, you can purchase directly on our website.
All right, that's great. Thank you very much, Corey.
Thank you.
So that dry case thing looked really cool, but it got really funny after we got off the air on the recording. Corey from DryCore saw my Podfeet pin, and I handed him my card, and it had the Podfeet on it. And he said, "Oh, you work in the field of podiatry." Okay. You know, I've often wondered if I might have a branding issue, but, you know, I laughed it off. He then told us about something even cooler that they sell, though, so I'm kind of glad he made that mistake. They have a product they market through podiatrists called the Dry Pro Cast and Bandage Protector. The Dry Pro is a sleeve that you slip over your arm or your leg, and when it's over the arm, it's kind of like a big mitten on one end, and then it seals around your arm. You suck out the air, again, with a little pump, and get this, you can go swimming or take a shower with a cast on your body. How cool is that? You know, it's long been a pet peeve of mine that there hasn't been a solution to this problem. You know, the idea I had was, why don't they create the case with the cast with a honeycomb material that would allow air and water to freely flow in and out, thereby not rotting out the cast, but still providing a lot of strength. The only problem with my idea is that I went into a coma whenever my material science professor in college opened his mouth, so it's probably not even possible. Well, in the meantime, if you know someone with a broken limb, have them ask about the Dry Pro from drycore.com. I'm in the Sprocket booth now with Jerry Musset, and you've got an interesting product I'm looking at here.
Yeah, thanks very much, yeah.
So what are you guys selling?
Well, we're selling like a secure enclosure, secure browser for an enclosure and a browser for iPads. So basically it's like a kiosk, it's a little micro kiosk.
So instead of hooking up a bunch of PCs with a lot of power and all that kind of stuff, you just hook your iPad into this bracket and then run the software?
Absolutely. We design kiosks for, they're about, you know, $6,000. These ones, you know, you can have them for $800 and you've got a kiosk going. Yeah? So they're fantastic.
So that's the software and the hardware?
That's the software and the hardware, yeah.
So how do you keep people from going in and messing around and just playing a video on the iPad?
Yeah, well, there's two things. Yeah, we've got like, we hide the home key. So they can't, you know, they can't boot out of it.
Can't push it in the first place.
They can't
okay.
get there. And the next thing, then we've got our own browser, our own lockdown browser called Padlock. And what that does, it enables the user to predetermine where they want the people to go and how long they want them to go there, so they can, you know, basically manage the user for them.
So they have a timeout, for example, that they're only in it for a certain length of time.
That's right. Particularly for museums and libraries, and you want people not to be on there browsing, you know, for 1 hour or so.
So can they only do what you let them do? Like right now, I don't know if you can see, Steve, but there's a launch pad thing going right here that shows the full name, company, email. This is for us to sign up to your company, right?
Yeah, that's right, exactly. So that's it. They can't go anywhere else other than that.
That's it, huh?
Yeah,
okay.
And it's easy to adapt and to change and modify, you know, so it's great.
That's a very interesting product. Thanks for taking the time with us today, Jerry.
Okay, thank you.
You know, this was one of the most exciting products I saw at the show. Remember when Jerry said the price was $800? After we got off the air, he idly mentioned that the $800 included the price of the iPad. So, assuming it's a $500 iPad, that's only $300 for the launch pad. Now, you might not think this product's so cool because, like, as a regular human, how often do you need a kiosk device? But sit back and think about the company where you work. I bet they've had needs for kiosk devices at trade shows or maybe an internal function when they'd like to be able to get people to enter some info. A registration system, anything like that? Imagine becoming a hero showing an $800 device versus thousands of dollars for a traditional kiosk. Just keep it in the back of your mind, and I bet you could be that hero. I'm here in the HyperMac booth, and I've always wanted to talk to somebody about the hyperdrives, and I'm with Lindsay Spruill from the company. And what do you have to tell us about today?
Well, basically, we are the only external batteries for the MacBook, and we also have for iPhones and iPods and iPads, we have these two batteries. The micro will charge your iPhone 3 whole full charges and also an iPad up to 5 hours. And the mini will charge, it's exactly double, so it will do 6 full charges and 10 hours extra additional on an iPad.
Now, anybody who's only listening, these are bright flaming orange, red, purple, yellow, green, blue, purple, gray, silver, and black.
Yeah, it's a perfect gift. It's perfect girly gifts, or just you can look kind of rich down there with the silver and the... They're also like aluminium, they're military grade lithium ion cells, rechargeable up to 1,000 times. We do.
They even feel good.
I know, they're great, right? They're like glamorous chocolate bars.
Yeah, they are. You find yourself wanting to touch them, they're touchable.
And people do. We find ourselves cleaning them a lot, yeah.
Now, you described the mini and the micro, and then there's a nano here too?
Yeah, the little nano, this is actually, you charge it through here, and then this is for charging Android, BlackBerrys, other smartphones. So this isn't for the iPhone.
So that's got the micro USB connector in it.
Right.
I see. Well, we need those too.
You too, like a little additional magnetic feature.
They thought of everything.
Every girl should have one in the stocking.
I think so. So how much do these run?
Well, these ones retail at $69.99.
That's for the Nano?
For the Nano. The Micro is $99.99 and the Mini is... $119.95. But we do have show specials on, so anyone that's lucky enough to be around the show today can come and pick up a deal.
Get a better deal.
Yeah.
Now, I've always been interested in the batteries for the MacBooks as well. So what can you tell us about those?
Yeah, sure. We, like I said, we are the only company that does the external battery for the MacBook. They come in 4 different sizes. Depending on what MacBook you have, for example, like the MacBook Air, you could, with this little one... you could get almost 2 full charges. So once it's run out, I mean, basically it goes from, like you say, extend your battery up to 20 hours.
Oh, wow. Now, I have a MacBook Pro, so I've got to have an 85 watt, but I see 60, 100, 150, and 222.
MacBook Pro 15, 17, 13.
The 15?
15.
Yeah.
On this little guy, you probably only get like 1 full charge, so you would want something a little bit more... with a little more wattage up here. So this one, I think, would give you like 1.5 full charge. I mean, the interesting thing is just like, you know, I mean, like this one would recharge your iPhone 14 full time. So
that's fun.
And the good thing is not only is it, you know, able to charge your MacBook, it will charge anything with USB too. So it's a great thing to have.
Yeah, that's a good point, is that so a lot of the devices maybe are less expensive, but they only do one thing, and you guys can cover all these different kinds of products, right?
Yeah. Yeah, great for the, you know, you want to watch a movie? How many times does your battery run out in your computer when you're trying to watch a movie on the plane?
The new MacBook Air is probably going to hurt your business, I think, because that battery's crazy. But I have an old MacBook Pro, so,
definitely... Okay. That's all that matters. So right. You come to us, we'll give you a deal.
It's all about me, right?
Yeah.
So it looks like they range from about $200 up to
$500. $200, $300, $400, $500. But again, we have the show special, so...
Got that going on. Yeah. All right, thank you very much, Lindsay.
Right,
I appreciate
you.
Your time.
Thank you.
You know, I've always wanted one of those HyperMac battery packs. The little ones for iPhones and such that Lindsay showed were so cool looking. Very hot, cute little devices. The Mac batteries are really cool too, but they're really expensive. Dang, they're cool. But they are expensive. Oh well. Well, I've been neglecting a really cool feature of Screen Steps, but I'm going to rectify that situation right now. My problem is that I have no imagination. I think ScreenSteps is perfect just the way it is, but luckily both users and the ScreenSteps guys both think that it can never be perfect, and they keep coming up with all these new features and capabilities. This time, let's start with a problem to be solved. You're writing on a message board, either trying to describe a problem or trying to explain a solution to someone. Sketch are great for referencing a screenshot, but what if you need to describe several steps with a lot of screenshots? Well, you would naturally reach for ScreenSteps to create the instructions and multiple screenshots, but where do you put the lesson after you write it? You can't put it into the blog post help file or the forum where you're working, really. If you sign up for a free ScreenSteps.me account, though, you can simply click the export button in ScreenSteps and upload to that account, and boom, you've got a URL you can just send to someone. You can say, here, I wrote a lesson for you right here. Now, I'm going to explain more how this works over the next few weeks, but if you're curious now, head over to ScreenSteps.me and watch their little video and then sign up for a free account. If you haven't bought ScreenSteps yet, be sure to use my coupon code NOSILLA, that's my name spelled backwards in all capital letters, for 25% off the purchase price over at ScreenSteps.com. And that's the purchase price on ScreenSteps, not on ScreenSteps.me, because as I said, that's free. I'm here in the Smart Technologies booth with Marina Gerinazzo. How are you doing today?
Great. Thanks, Allison. Great.
All right. So I've seen smart boards before where it's just you draw on a whiteboard and all the information gets sucked into your Mac, but it appears to be that you've gone up a notch here.
We have. This is the new Smart Board 885iX Interactive Whiteboard. It's our 800 series board, brand new. It's shipping at the end of the month worldwide. This particular Smart Board Interactive Whiteboard allows for multiple users, multi-touch, gesture-enabled. So anything that you're doing on your Mac that somebody would do on their desktop, on their Mac, or on their iPad, in terms of that functionality, now you can do it on this large display surface. And, it affords a great opportunity for interaction, collaboration, working with the data. It's a great tool for teaching, but, of course, also in business settings for working with information.
So I'm having trouble paying attention because this is fascinating over here. I mean, she's drawing, she's doing, different kinds of line drawings, but I've also seen all kinds of architectural stuff up here. And, oh, man, she's got a compass now. I want to play with the compass.
So this is part of Math Tools, which is a software program that we developed that really enhances learning about math. It's a fantastic product. It's been tremendously popular. Because it's so visual, and
yeah, this is
really brings it alive.
Like I said, I keep just watching her. So you can draw on it with your fingers or with a pen?
That's right, yeah. So it also has the ability of what we call object recognition. So it recognizes when you're using a pen, when you're using your finger, or when you're using your fist, back of your palm, to erase.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so it's a very sort of intuitive way of using the interactive whiteboard because it recognizes what it is that you want to do.
Wow, this is amazing. And I'm afraid to ask, what's the retail price on this?
Actually, for education, the pricing is reasonable. What our reaction has been with educators. It's about $5,000.
What if you're not in education?
Not in education, the pricing is
$7,500. $7,500. Still, for what this is doing, this is... This is pretty amazing. Is there anything else you want to tell me about it?
Well, I'd say that this is amazing, but Smart as a company is celebrating 20 years in the touch technology industry. Our first interactive whiteboard came out in 1991. So it's 20 years that we've been developing touch-enabled products. This is our latest version of the interactive whiteboard, but we've developed a whole range of other products that are touch-enabled.
And now, where would... Right. I was going to say, for some reason, people think that... don't be drawn on the Mona Lisa smile there. So, for some reason, people think that Apple invented touch, and it's very, very far from that, for sure.
There are a number of companies that have contributed to touch. We certainly applaud Apple in bringing touch to the forefront and helping consumers and business people around the world recognize how touch can be used. But they're not the only companies out there that are developing touch products.
So if somebody wanted to get more information, where would they go?
They'd go to www.smarttech.com, S-M-A-R-T-T-E-C-H.com.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Allison. a great show.
You too. Well, like I said, I've always been intrigued by these smart whiteboards, but the smart displays were even cooler. Imagine being able to drag a design around on a 50-inch display with your hands, draw on it, circle problem areas, have two people circling problem areas and talking, write notes on it. It's really, really cool. What I need to figure out is what applications it supports, because I'm betting they have to have like drivers or something like that for the touch interface to work with each application. Anyway, something definitely good to look into for a work environment. Now, I don't want you guys to get burned out on interviews, so I'm going to stop here and we'll have three more next week. The last couple are really good, so I'll leave you with that tease.
In a world where only Hondas exist.
No, you can't say only Hondas exist. They'll sue us.
Okay. In a world where Hondas exist, there's only one man that can help you help you.
No, not that either. I'm sure there are lots of mechanics, so you can't say only one man.
I can't say only one man. Geez, come on, I'm trying to big this up, you know, so stop interrupting me. In a world where Hondas exist, there's a man that can help you help yourself. Honda Bob. Honda Bob will come and repair your Honda at your home while you check the skies for invading aliens.
No aliens in the script, definitely not.
What? None? No aliens? What sort of score is this? Okay. Although not associated with Honda and Honda Acura worldwide, a fully qualified Honda Bob can stop those gremlins from ruining your drive to
work. I didn't say that there were gremlins in the store. No gremlins or monsters. Nope.
What do you mean, no monsters? Jeez, I'm trying to big this movie trailer up, you know.
It's not a movie.
Huh? It's not a movie? Honda Bob just comes to your house and fixes your Hondas and Acura cars? If you live in Los Angeles or Orange County in the US, you can call him on 562-531-2321 or email him at hdabob@aol.com. He even has a website over at hdabob.com. Honda Bob isn't affiliated to Honda Acura or Honda Worldwide. Okay, so why the film score?
It was your idea. You wanted to do something with iMovie.
Wasn't my idea. You said, let's do a film trailer. It would be fun.
Yes, but not about Honda Bob, don't you remember?
Oh, right. Not about Honda Bob. Okay, okay.
You aren't still recording, are you?
What? Yes, I am still recording. Yeah, okay, I'll stop. Honda Bob just comes to your house and fixes your Hondas and Acura cars. If you live in Los Angeles or Orange County in the U.S., you can call him on 562-531-2321 or email him at hdabob@aol.com. He even has a website over at hdabob.com. Honda Bob is not affiliated to Honda Acura or Honda Worldwide.
Well, wasn't that special? That was our little friend Gazmaz from the UK. I'm speechless. Let's keep going here. Let's see. We only have a few things shaking out in Security Light this week. It's Patch Tuesday for Microsoft, and they've got 12 bulletins out on it. It's got Windows stuff, Office for Windows and Mac. Everybody's going to get to play next week. Three of these are critical, so be sure to let the updates run, wake up your virtual machines, or, you know what, delete them if you're not using them. Adobe is getting on the Patch Tuesday bandwagon as well. They've issued an advisory for Adobe Reader 9.4.1 for Windows and Mac. Looks like this is a critical update too, so make sure you let Adobe run its updates. Maybe get rid of it too. Finally, VLC from Videoland.org issued a notice of a vulnerability that could allow arbitrary code execution, our old favorite. Now, since media players can be invoked without your directly opening them, be sure to open up VLC, let it check for updates, and run the update, and you'll be safe again. Now, in my case, I'm not sure if it always works this way, but my VLC automatically offers to look for updates for you, but you get to choose check or don't check every time, so it's not exactly automatic. Be sure to let it check. I just updated to 1.1.7 when I was writing this, so be sure to get out there and get her done. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond. And this week we have Alistair Jenks from New Zealand and also from the Sitting Duck podcast back with us again today. How are you today, Alistair?
I'm pretty good here on our national day in New Zealand, Waitangi Day.
What's it called?
Waitangi Day.
Waitangi Day. What does that mean?
Waitangi. It commemorates the treaty between the British coming in and the indigenous Maori people, basically saying that, yeah, we'll both stay.
Oh, wow. Well, that sounds like fun. Well, I appreciate you taking off your time from this holiday. No, it's actually Saturday for me, but it's Sunday for you, right?
Yeah, which means we don't get a day off this year.
Oh, that stinks. We always have ours on Mondays.
Much discussion about that this year.
I bet. All right, well, let's dig in today. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, and I think we had started to briefly talk about it once before, and we said we'd do a whole show on it, was I wanted to talk about why people might want to consider going from iPhoto up to a fancier photo management program like Aperture or possibly Lightroom. And you've actually got experience in all three. I'm kind of the iPhoto Aperture side. You've got more Lightroom and a little bit of Aperture. So I thought it might be kind of fun to start walking through that.
Yes, well, I was doing a little research on this in the last few days, and there's actually less and less reason, which was quite a surprise to me, to upgrade from iPhoto to Aperture.
Hmm.
Because, of course, you know, I went under the covers and started looking at all the individual features and seeing what iPhoto has and doesn't have and what Aperture has and doesn't have, and they're actually getting very similar. Because I forget who it was. It might have been on your podcast recently. Somebody was saying that Apple has a technique of producing consumer software and pro software and then gradually migrating the features from the consumer to the pro and vice versa. And that's happening big time between iPhoto and Aperture. And we now see in Aperture 3, we've got Places and Faces, Flickr integration, Facebook integration. Those are all consumer things, and they've now found their way to iPhoto.
Well, it's kind of funny. Usually you would think it would go from the professional software down, but they do it the other way around.
Well, they do it the other way as well, because iPhoto's adjustments, you know, when you say adjust the photo, they're actually quite sophisticated now.
Hmm.
You know, when I first started using iPhoto, I got my first Mac, well, my only Mac, 4 years ago. And, well, you've heard my review of the latest iPhoto on your show recently. I still don't like it, really. But that long time ago, 4 years ago, the adjustments in iPhoto were pretty naff, really. There was very little you could do. Now it's actually quite powerful. You know, you've got definition and shadows and highlights and all that stuff's in there.
Oh, really?
So it's actually, I think it could actually be powerful enough for many people, even as they improve their photo processing learning and capability.
So one of the biggest things for me was that I like to have a fairly structured organization to my photos. So I looked at, before I went into iPhoto or Aperture, I had been keeping my photos in folders, and I keep them in folders by date. So I've got all my 2010 photos together, my 2009 photos together, and then within each of those, it's by quarter, and then within a quarter, it'll have the date first, like 2010, 11, 17, and then the event name of what went on in there. And having that structure allows me to just really rapidly find things that I'm doing. And it's not that hard to set up as you pull things in. It's not like I did it after the fact and went, oh, when was this photo taken? And last time I checked, iPhoto didn't allow you to do any kind of embedded folder structure.
No, that is one of the big differences. As I say, I don't use iPhoto that much, so I had to go in and have a look around to be familiar with it.
I didn't know we were going to do facts and data, Alistair. I thought we were just going to be opinionated. That's well, a way yeah, we could I go. I just didn't know.
No, I need to base my opinion on fact is the problem. You can do albums and smart albums in iPhoto, which is, you know, very much the iTunes model. I think iTunes began that. But that's all you can do. You can't have those folders. And although you can manage the photos in a folder structure, you're left to do that by yourself. And then you have, when you import them, you have to say, I'm importing these by reference. So you have to do something special. And then you can do it, but it's messy.
Hmm.
And if you do give the photos to iPhoto and say, take care of them, the folder structure that it uses is an abomination. Hmm. It really is. Whereas in Aperture, you can still do the copy by reference and do it all yourself if you really want to. But even if you give them to Aperture to put in its library, you can still do it all that structuring, which is a huge advantage for people like you and me who use that type of folder naming.
And I guess it has to do with how many photos you take too. I mean, if you take pictures at birthdays and Christmas and that's it, you're okay. But I'm pushing something like 80,000 photos last time I counted. So, you know, if those were just in events one after another, that'd just be a nightmare to ever find anything.
Yeah, and I think that the trick is the name events. It is for events, and I take, you know, I'll take my camera out to the local airport. I like taking pictures of planes, and I might take two or three photos of something interesting. And then the camera will sit in my bag for a couple of weeks, and then I'll take it out again, and I'll take a few more photos. So when I import, I might have 3, 4, 5 days worth spread over several months. And they're all of the same thing at the same place, planes at Wellington Airport, but it doesn't make sense to have them as events.
Yeah.
So I just have this stream of photos that occurred at some time. And even putting them in date-based folders is not entirely sensible for me, because it's just a stream of photos. What makes a lot more sense to me is to be absolutely anal about tagging. And that's something I've had to drill myself in very recently. And in fact, we'll touch on that later when we get to the processing workflow.
Now, is there tagging in iPhoto?
There is, and it's actually better than Aperture, in my opinion.
Uh-oh.
Well, actually, no, I'm confusing myself. iPhoto and Aperture have the same mechanism. In fact, they seem to share the same tags.
Oh, okay.
Lightroom is the better one.
Oh, okay, okay. I'm not quickly seeing tags. I'm playing around in there right now looking at photos, but...
Keywords,
oh,
tags.
Oh, keywords, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, effect. That is what the same thing they call it, yeah.
Yeah, I hate that. I absolutely hate the way Aperture does it. Lightrooms is so much easier.
Okay. I do some tagging, and actually that's something I'm curious. I haven't really got a strategy. I'll go through a phase where I'll think, okay, I want all my Macworld photos to have a tag of Macworld. That would make sense. But then do I do every kind of event I'm going to do? Would I have a tag for that? And then maybe that event will never occur again and there's not very many photos in that. Is that a waste of keyword space or something like that? So I tend to tag or do keywords like for people or like best of. I've got a category for that, or a tag for that, and that's what I have synced over to my iPad, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I think the thing with keywords is it's many things to many people. Perhaps the most important thing is if you've got a folder structure, and particularly if it's based on events, don't tag for events because you've already got that information.
Yeah, that's
so
true.
You might tag it as Macworld because Macworld will recur over the years, and you would certainly tag people because they will recur and be at different events. But it's basically a different way of filtering your content. So I mean, in my case, you know, the date-based folders are sometimes useful, like if I go to an air show, for example, but then I'll have an event that's, or an album that has that whole air show anyway. But tagging different aircraft types.
Oh, that would be good.
So, you know, I can go and find all my photos of 747s, for example, no matter where and when they were taken. That's useful. I also tag the airport that I take the photo at, because it usually is at an airport or airfield. So again, I can go and find all photos of a particular type at a particular airport.
Oh, yeah, yeah, so yeah.
It's different ways of filtering it. But if you look at a folder structure, there's no obvious folder structure I can use for either of those. You know, I could have a folder for one airport or a folder for one type, but it seems contrived to me.
Yeah, yeah. And the whole concept of events, like our trip to Europe, for example, to me, that's a single event, but within that, there were events of, you know, when we were in Scotland with Gazmaz, or when we were in Belgium with Nightwise, you know, those were separate events within it, but they're all part of one big event, but there's no way to do that. That would just be a giant pile of folders of events by date. There would be, you know, 2 weeks worth of events for that, and that isn't at all what I want it to be.
You could tag it with Belgium or Nightwise or Gazmaz or England or...
Yeah.
All of the above.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I guess what you have to figure out is what are you in the future going to be looking for?
Right. That's a good point.
Which is not easy.
A lot of times what I'm really looking for in the past is I want to prove something, like somebody was somewhere, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Or the one big thing I use, iPhoto 4 is creating calendars. We do a calendar every year. And so I just had to take all my photos out of Aperture that I wanted. And I went through, you know, best of and ones with Al and Steve and, you know, did it by the tags on names. And then I dumped those all out to back into to iPhoto to do that.
Yeah, it's an interesting distinction that iPhoto actually has more capability on the publishing front than Aperture does. Yet Aperture does have some. I don't quite understand what the differentiation is there. Supposedly, I've read that Aperture does much better books than iPhoto, but I don't know how or why.
Yeah, now I did my first book. My mother's 90th birthday was this last summer, and I took a bunch of pictures of her and the family on the boat on the little trip we took for her birthday. And I dumped them all into a book, and I started messing around with them. And I found it to be really, really dodgy. I had a lot of trouble where I would try to start moving an image, you know, sliding it around, and it would just stop sliding around. I had one that I was never able to resize. It was blown up. It turned into kind of a cool artsy-fartsy effect, so I ended up keeping it. But it wasn't at all what I was trying to do. My intention was to have the whole photo shown, and it was actually the inside of the dust jacket is half of my mother's face from when she was a little baby girl. And it looks really cool. It's really, really neat looking. Not at all what I wanted it to be, but I went, whoa, that looks neat, though. And everybody thinks it's all artsy-fartsy, but I didn't mean to do that.
Well, I guess we also have to remember that there are a myriad of online services that can make books and stuff that you can just do through a website anyway if it comes to it.
Oh, I hadn't actually ever tried that.
Yeah, we've even got several in New Zealand, which is quite saying something.
Yeah. One of the things I'm finding in looking through, I actually hadn't played with the new iPhoto very much until we've been talking just now, but it seems like a lot of the things are a lot more intuitive the way they're done. You know, like if you go into effects, they have a little picture to show you what sepia looks like in antique, looks like in matte and vignette and that kind of thing. And so as you do them, there's pretty little pictures to show you what's going to happen when you hit the buttons.
That's called consumer features. That actually is what puts me off.
Oh, you like it the hard way, the way
I like lots of sliders and numbers.
Well, if you go into adjustments, though, you do get the level controls for exposure and contrast and saturation, those kinds of things, like you said, definition.
That's what I'm saying, that has improved a lot in recent versions of iPhoto. So there's actually less reason to go up to the more professional stuff. That used to be one of the key reasons, is you had more control over how you processed your photos.
So one of the big things I see as an advantage in Aperture would be, say, for example, there's a definition slider in iPhoto. Well, there's definition in Aperture too, but there's the brush adjustments for those things. And that's, to me, one of the biggest differentiators beyond the folder structure is I could say, I can take a brush and say, with this brush, I want to just make Kyle's eyes sharper so that they sparkle more, that kind of thing. Or I just want to dodge and burn on this little part right here because it's a little underexposed. Where I think in iPhoto, you pretty much do it to the whole photo from what I can see.
You do. And I know that's one of the features that Bart loves as well. He's been raving about that in various places.
What's funny is he told me about it, and then I forgot about it for a long time, and someone else told me about it, and I said, Bart, guess what? There's this really cool thing. He's like, you moron, I told you about that. You used to do it. And I was like, oh, I forgot.
Yeah, but we have to also remember that only came out in Aperture 3, so that's actually quite a recent
Only about a year ago. Yeah.
Addition to this equation. I think the thing with iPhoto is you have the photo and you do things to the photo. And when you get to Aperture, they start letting you do lots of, you know, very specific tweaks that iPhoto is more about, I've taken a photo, I just want to make it look nice and get it out there. Aperture is, I'm a photographer, I know what I'm doing, let me do it.
Right. And I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm learning.
Well, yeah, we all learn. And one of the best ways to learn is start pushing those sliders around and see what happens. Yeah, in fact, the definition slider, for example, in Lightroom, it's called Clarity. Mm. And I had heard one of the Photoshop guys, Matt Koslowski, I think it was, say that he always uses the Clarity slider in Lightroom. And he told us, you know, 20... that whatever number he used to slide it to in most cases, and he said it always improves the photo. And I thought, you're right, it does. It looks really good. But why? What's it doing? So I just started playing with a slider, and I eventually found a photo that showed me exactly what it does. If you find something that's got a very hard white edge against a blue sky and you start moving that slider, you'll soon see what happens. You get some very surreal effects.
Oh, And that was able to show you what it was doing?
I could see exactly what it was doing, and now I understand why Clarity works, and therefore I'm a little bit more careful in using it, because you can get caught out by many of these adjustments and creating unreal situations in your photo. In fact, I remember one using the fill light, as I think Lightroom calls it, fill light, and aperture. It's just the shadow adjustment where you can brighten up the shadows and get more detail out of them.
Okay.
I had a picture of a tiger moth flying by, and I had used the fill light to, you know, improve the detail in the shadows, and my brother pointed out to me that I had completely changed the way that the registration letters had been painted on the side. In the original photo, they were solid black, and in my version, they actually had hollow centers in the letters.
Yeah, okay, my favorite part about that story is I thought you were talking about a bug.
No, an aeroplane.
I was going to say, Bart loves pictures of moths.
We don't paint registration letters on our bugs.
That's when I picked up on it. Mine like a steel trap here, let me tell you.
So you do have to be careful with what you're doing, and understanding what those sliders do does help in that respect.
So now, one thing I did want to mention was price. Aperture has long been $200, and I believe Lightroom is $300. Fairly big distinction. But now with Aperture down to $80, I wonder if that's going to put some pressure on Adobe to bring out a lower price product.
Yeah, I'm not the only person who has bought it and then tried to justify it.
Well, I mean, if you're a professional photographer, that's not a big difference in money. That's not a huge deal, right?
No, because I think it was Shai was saying that, you know, he can afford all these amazing plugins because they get paid for on the next job that he uses them on.
Right. So, yeah, and in his case, if it's a if it's something that speeds him up, his time is actually money in that case. And in our case, or at least in my case, I'm just fooling around. I don't get paid more if I correctly whiten somebody's teeth, you know?
No, I have sold one photo, but I think that was an exception rather than the rule.
Well, that's pretty cool. So what do you see as the big differences between Lightroom and Aperture?
Canon
versus Nikon? Is it the same? Is it just two, six, one half dozen the other?
If you go online and look at the arguments between the two, it's very Canon versus Nikon. They're both great pieces of software, and each has its strengths and each has its weaknesses. And really, I think when it comes to the management aspect, it's very much what you prefer. But I have found when actually processing individual photos that Lightroom, I think, actually wins the race. Not significantly, but definitely. Some of the sliders are more effective than an aperture. You know, I move the slider and aperture halfway, and I'm thinking, is it working? Whereas if I move it halfway in Lightroom, it's completely ruined the photo. So I've got more control. I can put more of an effect in, and I find sometimes in aperture that I can't put enough of the effect in to get what I'm looking for. Noise
like
adjustment
saturation.
Or noise.
Oh, there's something you might not know. I'll tell you a little trick on the effect sliders on aperture. And I know it's going to shock some people, but I did do a great deal of reading when I first got aperture. If you're sliding, say, the exposure slider, let me see if I get the right keystroke. One of these, like holding the control. Yeah, no, that's not it. Shift. There's a key you hold down and you can actually go past the end of the slider.
Ah.
And now I can't remember what it was. I'll have to find that. I'll put it after the show, or maybe I'll keep just dinking around while you're talking and find it. But yeah, there is a way. There is a way to just go past the control to the end.
Yeah, because Lightroom 2, I used to use the noise reduction, and I often wondered what was the point, because it seemed to be targeting noise that was on a different scale to what I was looking at, and I never quite figured out how to make it do that. And then when Lightroom 3 came out, one of the advertised upgrades was far better noise cancellation, and it was amazing. You just grab that slider and move it until the noise disappeared. End of job. It was great. It was amazing. A lot of pros said it was very, very effective. Now I come to Aperture and I'm back to the original Lightroom 2 model where, you know, I can see it's having an effect, but I'm not seeing the noise just disappear like it does in Lightroom 3.
Okay. Yeah, and that's where you start spending your fortune on plugins, right?
I have to admit, I've had a look at one of your guests mentioned one called Neat something or other.
Yes.
I had a look at the other day.
Yeah.
Is that Donald, I think, mentioned that?
I think it was, yeah.
Conference photography, yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm still balking at the price, but...
Oh, how much is it? I had a note to myself to actually go look it up, and I hadn't yet.
Well, there's multiple versions, and you have to get 16-bit image processing. You have to go to the pro version, which was $99. Mm. What I'm not sure is, because I'm using RAW, whether I'm immediately in the 16-bit realm or not, or whether it's the output has to be 16-bit. I'm not sure on that.
Okay.
And what I also haven't found yet is example photos in large numbers.
Okay. You mean to look at?
Yeah, I just want to look at this is before and this is after with lots of examples. I looked at several plugins to do that, and I wasn't too happy with the amount of information that was being provided, so I haven't made a leap yet.
I see. Okay, I'm looking at it right now at neatimage.com, and they've got a home and pro versions and single user. Oh, okay, yeah, no, but it's just a home and pro, and it was $49.90 and $69.90. But I'm looking at the Aperture version, so it looks like you buy them separately depending on what you're doing with it. There's Photoshop and standalone. So you must have been looking at that one where it talks about 64-bit and 32-bit.
Yeah, I may have been looking at two different plugins as well. I forget now, but there wasn't enough there for me to say, yes, I want that. That's really cool.
Just ready to do it, right? By the way, so I did find how to get the sliders to go back beyond the end. You slide it to the end, but then if you hover over the number that it shows to the right, you can just push and start to slide. You'll see your cursor change, and you can get to a much more dramatic effect.
Okay, must give that a try.
So just a little tip. Look at me knowing stuff, reading books and all. It's crazy. I might have blown my cover here.
You said something on your last podcast about this, and I took a mental note. Reading the book isn't about learning how to use your software or your gadget. It's about knowing what it can do. So that when you suddenly need to do something, like in my case recently, I needed to get a JPEG out of my camera when I only shot RAW. I knew it could create a JPEG from a RAW after I'd shot it. I just had to figure out how.
Oh, okay. So, but because you had read, you knew it was an option, but knowing how to do it.
I knew it was there, so I just kept looking. It took me about 15 minutes to find the blessed thing, but
At least you knew to go look, right? Right.
Yep. I would have given up after 3 minutes if I wasn't sure.
And the other thing I did want to clarify is I actually do read a lot of manuals, but I think that in general, I want to be able to try to play with it on my own first. But I think it is that hardware I tend to read manuals, but software, not so much.
Good software should just be easy to use from the outset for most things.
Yeah, if I pay $10 for something, I don't expect it to be so complicated I can't just cipher it up, you know? Yeah. If I pay $100 for it, I expect it to be more complicated, maybe require a little more reading.
Mind you, that's for people like you and me. There are others in the world who do actually need some help, so perhaps they should provide the manuals anyway.
Yeah, I think so. So are we ready to work on to move into workflow?
Yeah, that was another interesting voyage of discovery, as I actually tried to write this down rather than just do it. It's very different things, trust me. And this, again, sort of, it kind of brought out, because I'm really, really used to doing this in Lightroom and have recently been doing it in Aperture, I'm still adjusting to the way Aperture does things. And I can explain a couple of other differences in this process as well. The first problem that I kind of have and kind of don't have, because I've just got a new camera, is that Adobe Camera Raw gets updated far more frequently than Apple's Raw processing engine does. So Adobe have, wait for it, I'm going to get this right, Adobe have added support for my new camera, Apple haven't. Now, if I was using my old camera, Adobe Lightroom could convert my Pentax Raw files into digital negative files, DNG files, which is what I wanted. But my Aperture process can't do that, but my new camera can shoot DNG natively. Did you follow that?
Yeah, almost. I don't know any of the
why. I had a really hard time.
Yeah.
I had a really hard time figuring out whether I was going to be able to use Aperture with my new camera and old camera.
But because the new camera can so because the new camera can save into DNG, you can use Aperture where you can't use the RAW images.
Correct.
Huh.
Until Apple update it. So
what is your new camera?
And I don't know yet. It's a Pentax K5.
Okay.
I looked it up, about $2,000 with the lens that I, well, the lens that I have paid for but not yet got with it.
Okay. So into workflow now. Where does that fit in?
So importing, and the difference there between Lightroom and Aperture is that on the import, you could convert everything to DNG using Adobe's engine, and that's actually quite good because it compresses them really well. And I've talked to Bart about DNG, and I think he's still on the fence about it as to whether it will succeed as an open standard, because it is Adobe's, but they do make it open, so I don't know. But the idea of DNG is that it basically is a it's kind of like the PDF of the raw photo world.
Okay.
And that, you know, everything should be able to process it, whereas every model of camera that comes out has a different RAW format in it. But aside from that, importing an Aperture is actually better. I don't use a lot of the features that you can do on import. I made a note here in the iPhoto versus Aperture that you can do a lot more things when you are importing an Aperture. You can control that file naming and the location. You've can, of course, choose which library that you're working with, you know, which is the global repository. You can apply presets automatically. I don't understand how people do that. I can't take photos that consistently.
Well, I suppose maybe if you knew that you'd screwed up the white balance on a whole set of photos.
True. You could
maybe.
Do that. But
how often does that come up? Hopefully not often.
Well, white balance itself, I don't screw up too often. My cameras are generally pretty good at guessing it on auto. But if I do screw it up, I'm going to screw it up differently on each photo because I'm going to be trying to fix it.
Right. You know, I one of my favorite confessions to make lately is that I have a habit to get of getting stuck into where I think menus are or should be, and my brain simply doesn't look anywhere but where it thinks they should be. And I couldn't believe it. I've been using Aperture 3 for about, I don't know, 10 months or something when I watched Don McAllister's podcast about it. And on the import menu, he started talking about all those presets and things you can do on the right side. I'd never noticed them.
Yeah.
I never saw them. They were on the right. I look on the left, or I look on the top. I don't look on the right. And I even knew that you could set which folder it went into, but I never noticed everything below that. It was like it just never existed in my world. So I was kind of embarrassed by that. But yeah, the naming convention, that would have been real smart on the Macworld photos. Just have them all be, you know, MWE2011 underscore and then a number.
Yeah.
That would have been a great way to do it.
I went the other way around. I watched Don's video before I committed to purchasing Aperture. So
that's cheating.
That
oh, come on. That's cheating.
Well, what better way to have a look and see how it operates?
I love it.
So getting back into the workflow, importing, it's one of those things that I don't think we should talk too much about because you have to sort of experience it and figure out what works for you in terms of how you're managing your library, where you're getting your photos from, whether they're in RAW, do they have JPEGs with them, all of these things Aperture can handle with aplomb. But once you get your stuff into, at the very least, a simple project, I mean, even if your project is that memory card that I just inserted, which mine sometimes is, and actually that's a problem I have with Aperture. I put the memory card in and it says, great, what do you want to call the project? And so I say, okay, 2011, February, I don't know what date these photos were taken on. And there is no way, you can see the photos, but there is no way to look at the metadata for them to see what date they were taken on.
Well, you could go back to the, do a command tab back to Finder and ask it, right?
Yeah, because that's a really efficient workflow. It's just annoying. The photos are right there, unless I've got a calendar. No, not even a calendar is going to help, is it?
No.
Somebody's crossing off the days.
That's funny.
But that aside...
You're starting to sound a little like Bart on that one, but...
And this is what I touched on before. My next step in workflow, tag/keyword, everything first before you do anything else.
Really? Even if you're going to throw away, you're going to Bart at least 80% of your photos, you're going to spend time tagging them?
But you see, I don't bart my photos. I'll have to come up with a new term.
Ooh.
Do I AJ them?
It
has a good ring. I read an article. I meant to do some research online and see if I could find it. But I read an article many years ago. I think it was in one of our local magazines here. And there was some photographer, well known, but I hadn't heard of him at the time, in the States, who said he never threw away a single photo that he ever took.
Wow.
Now, in the film days, that's quite an undertaking. I suppose it's not, because you tend to get the whole film developed and the whole film printed, so you've got them anyway.
Right.
In the digital world, of course, it's very, very easy. You can take the photo and within seconds throw it away and it's never seen again. Or you can get them onto your Mac or PC and bart them there, and once again, they're never seen again. His point was this: some of the most famous photos in history were absolute junk when they were taken. Think, for example, that you have a photo of some individual who dies tomorrow. You could have the last photo of that person alive. Could actually be worth some money in some cases.
But if it's blurry, or, you know, their face is obscured by a shadow, or...
If I accidentally hit the shutter button while the lens is pointing at the grass or the concrete, I'll probably delete that. If I take deliberate test shots, like I got my new camera and I was just pointing it around the room and firing it off to see what it did, I'll probably delete those. But anything else, I was trying to take a photo of something that was worth having a photo of. So even if it doesn't come out looking great, it was still a valid subject, if not a good execution. And going back to aircraft, for example, somebody might ask me in years to come, has this aircraft ever visited this airport? Well, I may have a photographic record that's good enough to prove that it did, even if it's not got artistic merit.
Well, okay, here's another example. I'll take, I took photos of my dad's little cowboy in my light box, and I took 30 or 40 photos. I would only save the good one. Or if I took 30 or 40 photos of a person, I would only save the good one. Or butterflies, I would save the good one.
Yeah, I think it may be a sliding scale. Probably photos of the cowboy. I mean, I would keep them because I save a simple rule. I just keep everything. It's as simple as that. And by the way, that's a very easy process to follow, just keeping everything.
Yeah, it's a lot less work, but it's infinite disk space at that point. I have 80,000 photos, and I bart like crazy.
Disk is cheap.
Yeah, but it's hard to carry with me.
And take it another direction. If you are keeping everything, are you going to make sure that you take better photos more often? Just a thought.
I don't know. The way I believe in taking good photos is take lots of them, throw away the bad ones, and learn how to crop and adjust them nicely so that people think you're just an amazing photographer.
Yeah, and that works really well, I can tell you.
But, yeah, hey, are you mocking me? Alistair, I thought you were one of the nice guys. Yeah.
I'm mocking myself. I'll publish. There was a recent biking event that one of my sons wanted to go to, and I took 150 photos and published 37.
Mm.
Now, I bart them in the sense of which ones I'm going to publish, which I basically do by flagging the photos that I think are good enough. And then as I come to process them, like halfway through processing, I might decide that, no, I can't make this one good enough to, you know, to be satisfactory to me, and I'll knock that flag off and ignore it. But for the most part, I will publish a lot less than I actually took, but I still keep the ones that I took.
I'll give you another example.
You just never know.
This is where I may miss out. Is I took between 300 and 500 photos every weekend of my son's cross country and track team meets over the course of 2 years. So that was a crap load of photos. And now that I'm trying to get a little more serious about keeping things organized, I've actually gone through and I've thrown away probably 95% of those photos. And it may end up being that one kid turns out to be this amazing track star in college and win some big thing, and I could have sold that photo, but probably not.
Well, I mean,
I like disk space.
Yeah, but disk is cheap.
Remember, I carry everything with me at all times. It's always on my MacBook Pro. So I only have a 300 gig hard drive. Now I've got the 60 gig SSD too, but I don't keep it on an external drive. I keep it locally with me.
Yeah, mine are all on an external drive because I just don't have the room on my internal anymore.
It's because you don't burn anything.
True. But I tell you what, when this house starts burning down, I'm grabbing as I run out the door.
But see, I'll already have my MacBook Pro on my lap. That's true. Oh, okay. Oh, this is attached to your iMac.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, I'll give you that one. It's just a different way to think about it. And that's good because we're representing two different points of view here, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So tag every... Well, okay. Let's remodel that point. Tag everything that you're going to keep.
How's okay. that? All right.
Because what I find is that once I get into actually adjusting the photos, then I'm into publishing and it's like, oh, I suppose I should have put some tags on that. And I go back and I tag just the ones that I'm publishing. Mm-hmm. So maybe if you're not keeping everything and you are publishing everything that you do keep, it's less important to do it first. But I make myself tag everything because I'm keeping everything. And then I'll choose which ones I'm going to publish and they'll already be pre-tagged.
Actually, I think that probably is good advice because I think I just screwed that up with my Macworld photos. Is I had tagged a bunch of them and then I went to export some and it was like I had done some of them and not the others. It was just, and if I'd just done them all at once.
Yeah. So, and the next... Oh, sorry,
go
carry
ahead.
On.
No, go ahead.
Okay. So the next step after tagging, and that's the point at which I'll stop and say I can go away now and come back later and decide what I'm going to do with the photos. But I treat tagging as part of the import wherever possible. At least I try and school myself to do that because then everything's in and you can come back later and decide what you want to do with any photo at any time because you may come back in a year and decide that you want to grab a photo that hadn't previously been published or printed or whatever. So that's my cutoff point for getting them off the camera is tagging them.
Okay. Okay, that's good. And can you search by tags? I don't think or flags. I don't think I've ever flagged anything.
Tagging is you can definitely search by that, but that's more of my comeback later and what photos do I have of XYZ. Flagging I use when I decide that. So I took my camera out onto the Wellington waterfront the other day at lunchtime to take some photos, see how it operated. Got some fairly nice ones, so I imported them the other day and I thought I'll take the best of these and put them on Flickr.
Right.
So what I do is I go through and I flag the ones that I think are the ones that I'm going to publish. So you can, in Aperture, that's easy. You just hit the slash key, same as iPhoto for that matter.
I just learned that from you. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's easy. That's what makes it very, very immediate. You go through and think, yes, and then if you think, no, you just hit that key again and it takes the flag off. So when I've done that, and here's another keyboard shortcut that I just learned the other day, control slash automatically subsets to show you only the flagged photos. And then I get into the processing and I just process everything that I can see.
So if I'm in a library or within a project, I can hit control slash and it'll just show me the ones that are flagged in that group. Yeah, it did. Yep. Look at that. Uh-oh, how do you undo it?
Very quick. Same control, I think.
Nope.
Well, you just hit the X and the filter up the top right.
X and the filter in the top right.
I'm pointing, Allison. I don't know why I'm pointing.
Let's see. X means retouch. What are you? Okay. There it is. Yeah. Oh, that's very interesting. Okay. Huh.
So it makes for a very quick workflow.
I love keystrokes. I just love them.
There's bound to be a keystroke to turn that off, I'm sure. I just haven't found that one yet.
Right. Okay.
Basically I choose which photos I'm going to have a crack at making them publishable by flagging them and then just showing the flagged photos. Then you get into the fun part with all the sliders.
Hmm.
This is something I just do without thinking. And so I've actually stopped and analysed the order that I do things in. And some of this, the order is important, but it may have to go the other way around depending on what you're doing. So I guess it's what you're used to. First thing I do is crop and rotate. I have this horrible, horrible failing that when I think I'm holding the camera level, I'm actually slanting it about a degree and a half to the left. It's incredibly consistent.
How interesting.
And my new camera has an electronic level built in. And I was shooting with it when I was out on the waterfront the other day and snap, snap, I thought, oh, there's the level display. I'm tilted to the left. Surprise, surprise. And I tilted it until it said I was level. And yeah. I swear to you, I was tilting it to the right. It just felt wrong. But those horizons have come out dead straight on the photo. So
oh,
I can't
wow.
complain.
Maybe what you should do is tilt your head to the right when you're taking photos.
I don't know. I used to actually think my sensor was misaligned.
Yeah, I think so. I think you're off by a degree and a half. That's funny.
Well, no, I thought my camera sensor was misaligned, but maybe my brain is misaligned by 1.5 degrees or something.
Very precisely. You know, I think cropping is one of the single coolest things you can do to be to create an amazing photo. I was playing around with a photo I was really pleased with of a seagull down on the beach. And, this is another failing and old school problem I have is I have a tendency that if I took the photo in 4x6, 2x3, I will absolutely always crop at that same aspect ratio. And I sit there going, that doesn't look good. And then my daughter lives in a world where she hardly ever printed photos. Well, she did for a while. And she just comes out with all these crazy crops. I'm like, wow, what would make you think to do that? But I was looking at this picture of the seagull and I sent it to Bart and I was showing him. I was really proud of it because the color looked really cool. And it was just, I'd spent a lot of time on the same dang bird. And Bart took his checkbook and put it over the top of his monitor and made a crop visually on his monitor. And he goes, hey, try cropping it in a real wide-looking panorama. The picture just turned amazing with that crop. I mean, it was just huge, yeah. The difference in the shot.
Yeah, I think you talked about that one on the show, and that was actually the turning point for me as well. I used to hunt for the setting that said, keep the aspect ratio the same, exactly the same. And certainly if you go back through my Flickr stream, anything beyond about 2 or 3 months ago, they will all be 2 to 3 or 4 to 3, depending on which camera I was using, every single one. And I threw away photos because the crop didn't work.
Oh.
And now I realize that that's kind of silly, really.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was Bart's commentary, I think, in discussion of that photo, even if I remember correctly, that made me think, you know what? And hey, that last shoot that I did out on the waterfront, I've put up one or two that are square.
Wow.
The square looks good sometimes. And again, I was looking at the cropping and I wanted to get something out of shot because it was distracting.
Mm-hmm.
And if I got it out of shot, I also chopped off some of the good stuff if I was keeping the aspect ratio. So by going to square, I was able to keep the good stuff and get rid of the rubbish.
That's a good lesson. I'm glad not to be alone in that. Then it wasn't just me, but I think it's time for us to get out of the box. I mean, we don't print anything anymore. Oh, and that's another thing that's important about all three of these tools is that you really shouldn't have any fear of just hacking away at it, throwing crazy filters on, because all three of them will always let you go back to the original.
Yeah, and Aperture and Lightroom are much better at that because you don't have to go back just to the original. So with iPhoto, you can throw everything at it and then you can say, uh-oh, and you can go right back to the start. With Lightroom, you can throw everything at it and then you can go back to any point in the history of throwing things at it. And with Aperture, and I haven't quite figured out how to do this, but I read that you can take off any individual thing that you threw at it. So that Aperture gives you the ultimate control when you suddenly put that sepia tint on and think, uh-oh, that looks horrible. You can just take it right off.
Yeah, yeah, that is really fun. And I should say, I think there's a way in iPhoto to wreck your ability to go backwards. It seems to me there's a way that just says, you know, flatten it basically and make this be the main image. But if you don't actively do that, you should be okay. So all of these applications are actually doing what they call putting metadata on it. So they always reference back to that original photo, and there's a separate data file that says, take that image, on these three pixels here, you know, take out the red eye, crop like this. You know, they're adding all of these effects to it. So the original image is not ever destroyed on any three of these applications. So, you know, jump out of your box, go crazy, make a square crop like that nutty Alistair, and you can always go back if you decide you want to print a 5x7 of it, even though the crop will look stupid.
You can even do lots of different versions. Certainly in Aperture and Lightroom, you can create all sorts of crazy versions and still have the original.
Yeah, that I do like doing that. Somehow, even though I know intellectually that master file is protected, I still create duplicates sometimes going, well, okay, I don't want to lose the way I did that one. I want to do another one.
Yeah, you can spend a lot of time playing with this stuff, and you can spend, well, there's no danger in spending a lot of time other than losing time. Let's put it that way.
Right, you're looking at blocking his dinner. Right? Oh, I just looked at the clock, and we've been having a lot of fun here. We better speed up here, though, because we've been going a very long time. We didn't touch yet on exporting and publishing yet, though. Do we
that's
time
a really
to hit that,
interesting
or should
area.
We tease and go later on another show?
Oh, your choice. I mean, I can cover that fairly quickly because I think it's actually really, really simple.
Okay, go ahead then.
So I guess the biggest factor in this is where you publish and how you publish. If you print them, then Lightroom arguably has the best print module, though Apertures is pretty good and iPhotos is no slouch. But most people these days will publish somewhere online, and certainly the integration of Facebook and Flickr are a consideration for iPhoto and Aperture, although I hate those implementations.
That's why I use Poster. There are
inevitably plugins to solve your problem, and I can tell you something. If you're a Lightroom user and you want to export from Lightroom, check out Jeffrey Friedel's blog. He's got Lightroom goodies on one of his pages there, and those plugins are amazing. He has about, I think, maybe 24 for various different services, including Facebook and Flickr and Picasa and SmugMug, you name it.
Oh, cool.
And you can do anything you want as you export those. They are just astounding. It's one of the biggest things that I'm missing when switching to Aperture is having that kind of control. But I did find a plugin just called Flickr Export Plugin, and it's way better than the Aperture's built-in. The trouble with Aperture's built-in integration with Flickr, which has for many years been my publishing service of choice, is that it's very, very basic. So if you want to start putting descriptions on that appear on Flickr and controlling what groups they go to and lots for different photos that you upload all at once, go for the plugin route.
Actually,
I think there's really only one or two out there.
The one I really like, I'm really enjoying using Poster from Steve Harris of Reinvented Software. I did a review on it a few weeks back, and it's really nice to be able to tag your photos right there and put them into separate sets and all that kind of thing. It works really, really well. I'm very pleased with it. And for a first version, too.
I'm just looking up, if I can spell Aperture. Connected Flow is the company that produces the one that I use. So Flickr Export 4. And you can get a trial version which functions for 30 days. I think it limits you to uploading 3 or 5 photos at a time or something, but you can certainly test it all out. And it's the same kind of thing. It brings up a window. You've got all your photos there, and you can just click on each one and decide what's going to happen on Flickr with it. Whereas the built-in integration with Flickr in Aperture is... it's rudimentary. It really is. If you just want to dump everything on Flickr, then go to Flickr and arrange everything, then it's fine. It uploads them just fine, but you just can't control how it fits into your sets and groups
and
that kind of stuff.
And I hate the Flickr interface with every fiber of my being, so being able to do it outside is definitely a better way to go.
There's certain things you can only do in the web interface, but
I have successfully beaten it into submission on many occasions, but it's always a beating required, in my opinion. So let's see, what resolution do you upload at to Flickr in particular?
I set the maximum dimension to 1600.
Why
I suppose
that?
I should reconsider. Well, I suppose I should reconsider given my square photos and stuff like that, but. Because it originally came from my 6-megapixel digital camera, that was a resolution which enabled me significant cropping and still put it out at a reasonable resolution. Because this is the same thing as everything cropped to the same aspect ratio. I need everything to be the same size. Don't ask me why, I just do. So for the longest time,
I love it because you're making me not look anal at all.
And my new camera, which is 16 megapixels, that's about a third of the dimensions of the original. So the other thing is publishing them smaller does two things. Number one, it can hide some problems, like some noise and some lack of sharpness. And it it's mean to people with slow connections and small screens to give them a 16 megapixel photo to look at.
That's interesting.
I have yelled at my sister for that. Hey, look at these pictures of us standing in the snow. And so, oh, yes, okay, there's your left boot. Scroll, 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 scroll. Oh, no, that's actually your husband.
Well, but Aperture lets you do the, Flickr lets you choose which size you look at, so she can look at the little ones, right?
Yeah, but, it does. But I've been dealing with graphic files since they were a novelty. And I've seen so many abuses of file sizes and colored resolutions and all that sort of thing that I tend to get very picky about the way I do it. And the net result is I want to be nice to people.
See, I actually just throw them up in full res too. And I don't worry about the fact that other people can snake my photos if they wanted to, because I don't think there's any great brilliance out there. I probably should do something different, but... That's a conversation for when Bart comes back, because I know he has strong opinions on that too. Well, I think I'm gonna go ahead and cut us off. I know we had more to talk about, but I like leaving people guessing, because I would really love to have you on the show again. I always enjoy talking to Alistair.
Yep, and I certainly enjoy doing it myself.
Yay! So, where can people find you?
Well, my podcasting presence is on the Sitting Duck podcast, which I've just released onto a new host with a few tweaks. So you can now find that at sittingduckpodcast.com. And that gets released every Thursday. And it really does now. Didn't used to before.
It just pretended
to. I've made myself. Yeah, for a while.
And now you said you had another effort going on?
There's two main things that I do online. There's the podcast, which was sittingduckpodcast.com. And if you're interested in the photographs that I take, you can check me out on Flickr. But I also have a front, as it were, for my aviation photos, which is zkarj.co.nz. Or, in translation, zkarj.co.nz.
All right. Well, I really appreciate you coming on again, and we'll talk again soon.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Well, an absolute miracle has occurred. The show actually worked. I didn't have any trouble knocking on wood, knocking on my head. Anyway, I better cut my losses and close out the show right now, just in case, because I don't want to take any chances. Until next week, stay in touch by sending me emails, especially those dumb questions, to Allison@podfeet.com. And be sure to follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.